We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Well, this Time magazine keeps coming. Week by week, it pours through my letterbox. And the Bible speaks in such fashions that there's always things that are relevant to Time magazine. This time it's about a drought in California. California's facing a great drought. You might say, well, of course California's facing a great drought. It's always dry in California. But there's been a 75% drop in the rainfall and, more importantly, the snowfall, so that the Gibraltar Reservoir is now dry and farmers are facing ruin. In the 40 years he has farmed the fertile soil of California, Valley, Fred Starr has known his share of hardship, but never has he had a year like this. Rainfall, snowfall below normal have left the state parched, and Starr, with all 40 of his employees laid off, is struggling to survive. It's like being told that you're going to die, he says, until it happens. You think you just might make it. It's a great line, that, isn't it? Until it happens, you think it just might... It's like death, isn't it? And so these massively wealthy farmers and farmlands of California are really facing ruin, incredible ruin. The last paragraph is typical of Time magazine. As the Golden State turns brown, residents wonder how long the drought will last. No one can tell them. Astrologers, not always disdained in California, say that with Saturn moving towards Aquarius, the skies will begin to open. But whatever happens in the stars, an average season seems impossible. It would require 102 centimetres of rain now, and between now and May, almost unheard of. And another dry season begins. Technology hasn't saved and doesn't look like it's able to save the state of California's agriculture in producing the fertility of the land they need, and the astrologers, well, we can't even be sure they're going to get it right, but even they say there's not much chance. Jeremiah chapters 2 and 3 are basically unpleasant. It's a long poem which wanders and meanders over its subject, but verse 13 of the chapter seems to me to capture in a summary form what the whole chapter is about, and so on the top of the outline today you see verse 13 is printed there for you. And it becomes the framework of what I'll be saying in the next few minutes. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns, that cannot hold water. The first point to notice, it's my people. And it's very important that we catch that it is my people, because we're going to say things which, according to the Bible, are appalling. We're going to say things which are horrific. Has a nation ever changed its gods? We read verse 12. Yet they are no gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. The people who are my people have given up their God for things that are not gods. Why, even the nations who do not worship the truth, they worship false gods, hang on to their false gods, but my people have given up the true God. The relationship between God and his people is very important to see the absolute horror of this chapter. There are two images used to express this relationship. The image of the bride and the image of the first fruits. You see them in verses 1 to 3. The word of the Lord came to me, go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem. I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, though the land was not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. God's bride was Israel, and Israel was devoted to him. Israel loved him. Israel followed him even when he went out into the desert, followed him into a place which was not so, and followed him into the barren lands. Such was the nature of the devotion of the bride. And God led them. He led them through the wilderness and brought them into the fertile land, the promised land, the land flowing with the milk and honey, for God, the bridegroom, provided for his wife, protected his wife, and cared for his wife. The relationship of God and Israel, especially found in the Exodus, is one of a marriage of loving and caring, providing and devotion. The second image that's used is that of first fruits. At harvest time each year, the first part of the crop, the first part of any of the crops, the first fruits, were devoted to God, were given to God in sacrifice, which symbolized a thankful acknowledgement that all the crops come from God. But it also signified and symbolized that the rest of the crop was coming. That when I first see the grapes appearing, then I know the harvest is coming. And so these first fruits that appear are the symbol, are the guarantee, are the deposit from God that a harvest is about to arrive. Israel was the first fruits of the nations. For God is not just the God of Israel, God is the God of all the world. God is the God of all the nations. But Israel was his first nation that he chose. And he chose Israel so that he might inherit all the other nations. And so the way in which God took Israel to be his nation was to be a symbol of the fact that God was going to take all the nations to be his nations. And so Israel were especially his nation. Israel was the first fruits, special to him and special amongst all the nations of the world. And that's the horror of chapter 2 of Jeremiah. The horror lies in the fact that it was his people, my bride, my first fruits, my people who have forsaken me, the spring of living water. That the first fruits of the nations has done something that none of the other nations would ever do. They've changed their God. That the bride of God has done something that the normal married woman would never do. She'd become an adulterer, worse, a brazen prostitute. And so the two sins. The first is forsakenness. They have forsaken their God and followed other gods. They have forsaken their marriage and deserted their husband. They have forsaken being the first fruits of the nations, bringing them to me, rather than bring the nations to God, rather than be God reaching out to the rest of the nations. Why, this nation has committed adultery with the other nations and with the other nations' gods and acted in a way worse than any pagan nation would ever act. The actions of Israel were to forsake God both as bride and as first fruits. For this bride, rather than now following God, has followed worthless idols in verse 6. And as you follow idols, so you become like them, worthless. What fault did your fathers find with me, verse 6, that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. You know, it is said that dogs and masters look alike, don't you? And I saw one the other day that I nearly fell around in the park laughing as I just saw this very squat lady with her very squat dog walking off together. And it just looked marvellous. And it's one of the reasons I don't have a dog. Nothing could appear like me, or I wouldn't like to appear like it or something or other. But, so people will always grow to be like their gods. People are always just like their gods. It's the character of it. That as you seek to serve a god, so you become like them. And if the God you worship is a stupid God, so you become stupid. And if the God you worship is a worthless God, so you become worthless. You take the gods of the New Age movement at the moment, the crystals. I mean, anybody who really thinks that a little chunk of crystal, of glass, or of even plastic, as I've seen them, is actually going to change the way you think and integrate your brain and personality has become as stupid as the crystal they carry around. It really is dumb and inanimate. People who say to their to a stone or to wood in verse 27, "You are my father," and to a stone, "You gave me birth." They have become worthless and stupid. Or the materialist, the mechanist of our society, who thinks they're so clever because they've been able to dispense with God altogether. Everything is just one massive machine that pulsates along with energy particles, etc. But what is their lifestyle? Well, it's the lifestyle of the materialist that we see in our society, full of greed and avarice, with no values and no morality other than the bottom line of who has the most money. Whoever has the most money when they dies wins. A bigger crematorium flu or something. The materialist and the mechanist in the end becomes totally impersonal, for there is no person in a machine. So the people of Israel have followed their gods, which are worthless, the idols, and have themselves become worthless. They've changed gods, and they've accepted the gods of the other nations. They who are supposed to influence the other nations for God have been influenced by the other nations' gods. And so they are now following the Baals, with all their detestable fertility rites. For the Baal worship was an attempt of sympathetic magic. The gods of the Baals gave to the land fertility, according to the Canaanites, and the way in which you manipulate the gods into giving the land fertility is by sexual practices. And so up in their temples and their idols, they practiced sexuality with prostitutes, both male and female prostitutes, in all forms of abominable behaviour. You see, you and I have so sanitised religion, thanks to the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we always think that when people are going to go off to a temple and do something religious, it will be holy and pure. But remember, friends, most religion practices are not holiness and not purity. It's the practices of terrible immorality, like those religious practices where they burnt virgins each morning to raise up the sun. You see, different gods give very, very different morality, very, very different lifestyle. And the gods of the Baals were sexual in the extreme and in the most degenerate that is available. And so the image that's used, you see, of idolatry and marriage, adultery and prostitution are all rattled together here in Jeremiah chapter 2, because God's people, God's bride, have forsaken him to wantonly chase adulterous prostitution with the Baals. Pick up those verses, verse 23. "How can you say, 'I'm not defiled, I have not run after the Baals'? See how you have behaved in the valley. Consider what you have done. You are a swift she-camel running here and there, a wild donkey accustomed to the desert, sniffing the wind in her cravings, in her heat. Who can restrain her? Any male that pursues her need not tire themselves. At mating time they will find her. Do not run until your feet are bare and your throat is dry." But you have said, "It's no use. I love foreign gods. I must go after them." Or the image over in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, "If a man divorces his wife and she leaves him and marries another man, should he return to her again? Would not the land be completely defiled? But you have lived as a prostitute with many lovers. And would you now return to me, declares the Lord? Look up to the barren heights and see, is there any place that you haven't been ravished? By the roadside you sat waiting for your lovers, sat like a nomad in the desert. You have defiled the land with your prostitution and your wickedness. Israel, the bride of Christ, has pursued the Baals with a sexual avarice which is appalling. And the first fruit of God's harvest, the sign to the other nations that they were part of God's harvest, Israel has forsaken God for the sake of the other nations, not only in following their gods, but but in seeking the other nations as protection and as provision. So verse 18, why go to Egypt to drink water from the Shihor, a branch of the Nile, or go to Assyria to drink water from the river, which in this occasion is the Euphrates in Assyria? Or over in verse 36, why do you go about changing your ways? You'll be disappointed by Egypt, as you were by Assyria. Israel thinks that in the big superpowers of their day lies protection, safety and security, provision and wealth, but it's in God. For Israel is God's nation. God is the husband. God is the giver of the harvest. God is the provider of the rich, fertile land. Egypt is not. Egypt is the giver of slavery. Assyria is the giver of tyranny. But they think in the power of this world they will find safety and security. How did Israel get into such a mess? Into such a betrayal? Well, their actions flowed from their attitudes. Their actions of chasing the idols, their actions of trying to do business with Assyria and Egypt, flowed from their attitudes towards God. It's the way with all of us, isn't it, friends? Our thoughts, our attitudes, our values in one day create our words and our actions in the next day. It's like marriage, isn't it? It's in our hearts and our minds that we must be devoted to our partner. And as we are, we will continue to feed and be fed by each other's love. And as in our hearts and our minds we're not devoted to each other, as we do not continue to restore our relationship with each other, so we have the temptation and the possibility and the probability of wandering. Israel stayed ignorant of God. Look at the beginning of verse 6 and the verse 8 where the question is asked. They didn't ask, where is the Lord who brought us out of Egypt and led us through the barren wilderness, through a land of deserts and rifts, a land of... See, they didn't ask, where is the Lord? Or in verse 8, the priest didn't ask, where is the Lord? Those who deal with the Lord didn't know me. And the leaders rebelled, and then the prophets prophesied, not by God, but by Baal, and followed worthless idols. The first part of the error, which our Australian community is well and truly past, is the ignorance of God, is the ignoring of God, is the failure to turn back to the God that we know and knew in the first place. And it's very important for ourselves, friends. We are doing the right thing here in continually turning back to hear what God has to say, to know of what God has done for us. But it's not just here, of course. In our families it must be like that too, isn't it? That's why it's so important in our family life that we read the scriptures and that we pray with each other. It's important that the fathers do it. It's important that we fathers take responsibility to make sure that our children, that our wife, that we ourselves are asking, where is the Lord who brought us up out of Egypt? It's the first part of the straying process, but look at the descent that falls to them in verse 20. Long ago you broke off your yoke and tore off your bonds and you said, I will not serve you. That lovely stroke of independence. Who wants to be a servant? I don't want to serve anybody. I am a free man. I will not be the slave of any, not even of God. Which, of course, will lead you into a worse service of someone far, far worse than God. But it starts with that independence. And then it goes on to denial and deceit in verse 23. How can you say, I'm not defiled? I've not run after the Baals. That's what they're saying. Oh, I'm not defiled. I haven't done the wrong thing. Who, me? No, I haven't done the wrong thing. That's one of the first things, isn't it? Self-deceit. We see it in our children and we laugh, well, disciplining them and being very angry with them. And we laugh at their very, very crass lies. They're very unsophisticated, stupid deceits. They think they can fool us for a moment. No, not me. I didn't do that. And you know they did and it's all over their faces. And anyway, so is the jam that they've just stolen. I mean, you can see it. But we somehow think we can pull the same game with God in our sophistication. That we can say, no, I haven't done that yet. Oh, well, I haven't been serving you lately, but I haven't gone and when of course I have gone. And in verse 25, you go the next step down the track, don't you? Where you say, it's no use, I just love foreign gods. I must go after them. I mean, I can't help myself. I mean, I'm not responsible for it. It's in my genes. It's the way my mother weaned me. It's the way my grandmother weaned my mother. I mean, it just runs through our family. I just can't help it. I've got to go for these things. It's not my fault. They're just too desirable. I can't do anything else. And down to chapter 3, they wind up in verse 3. You refuse to blush with shame. You have the brazen look of a prostitute. You see, when you first turn aside from God, you move to doing the things that are wrong, but you deny that you do them. And then it's not a little while longer, and you start saying, well, yes, I do them, but I just can't help it. And it's not a little while longer before you start saying, yes, well, I do them, and there's nothing wrong with it. Has not our society just gone down that track? Was there not? I don't know, but I hear it was on a great exhibition of sin without shame last night in our society, as the gay community got together for its magnificent celebration with absolute shamelessness, promoting it, flaunting it before our community. We have moved in exactly the same way as a society, as Israel moved, though Israel were God's people, which makes it even that much more acute in its horror. It's all through this chapter. Verse 35 is a classic illustration of it again. I am innocent. God is not angry with me. They're not innocent. But so often people think God won't be angry with them. It's so modern. It's so typical of society, but it's also typical of individuals, isn't it? It's the shift that we ourselves attempted to. We're so silly because we can see the same pattern over and over again, repeated in other people, and yet fail to see it in ourselves, that as you ignore God, you move. Slowly but essentially you move. You start to deny, you start to pursue, you start to rationalise, you brazenly contend with him. And they fail to see that the one they were forsaking, their husband, their Lord of the harvest, is the spring of living water. He was the source of all things living. He was the basis for life. They're living in a land that is fairly barren, a land not unlike the California, a land which only has rainfall for half the year, and the other half was very long, and if the winter rains didn't come, or if they were less than usual, a land that was very marginal. And so it was very important to be able to have water. Water is a key figure in terms of life. Water is the most valuable commodity in California at the moment, as it was in Palestine, and God is the spring from which the water comes. And they're choosing cisterns that are broken. Now you have a moment's reflection on it, and you know it's the case, don't you? I've warned you before, I know almost nothing horticultural or agriculture, but even I can work out that if I'm offered two farms that are equal in every regard, but one has a spring of water that is always flowing with a river, and the other has a dam with a big crack in it, there's no doubt as to which one I'd be going for. One can't even hold water while the other's giving forth water. There's no doubt which one I would choose, even though I know almost nothing on the subject. They want harvests. They want prosperity, they want peace, they want security, and so they've turned from the one husband who is the source of all those things to foreigners who cannot give it. And so verse 13, the second half of the second sin, is that they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that can't hold water. Now I must confess some difficulty with this, friends. I've checked with a couple of people and they've confirmed with me they've got the same difficulty. We are really in the New International Version, but as far as I can see, Australians were not key to it. Because nearly every Australian I've checked with, only a few, but you can tell me later if you like, that nearly every one of us, when we use the word cistern, we mean the thing that's in the toilet. And so it's a little hard to work out why they're digging toilets in this regard, or digging things that will turn into toilets. In fact, why you dig down instead of putting up, and all kinds of problems with just the nature of the word. Now, Americans and English people who dominate the New International Version, they might use cisterns differently, but the only cistern I've ever had has been in a toilet, and I generally am told not to talk about toilets, especially in church, so I don't know what to do now. The cisterns they had were underground tanks. Again, because of the dry nature of the land, they would build their dams, their reservoirs, and plaster limestone walls that would give them water. And so they're underground reservoirs, which I would have thought is a much easier word for us than cisterns, and we don't have to think about the wrong thing. Now, rather than having the spring from which the water is continually flowing, they're choosing these great reservoirs, but the reservoirs they dig themselves actually can't hold water. They're cracked. The water's seeping out of them. One gives water, the other can't even hold it. The essence of forsaking God, doing your own thing, striking out for independence, the freedom to roam, as it says in verse 31, I will not serve you, as it says in verse 20, the making of your own gods for your own selves, the essence of their sin is doing their own thing, digging their own wells. But the nature of rebellion is that it will not work. We have the same rebellion. We think that there are alternatives to God that will work for us. The bank account, the education, the family, the house, the career. But it doesn't work and it will not work. We often are not asking the question, is it true? We're asking the question, do I need it? And our community is saying, I don't need God, basically because, well, I've got a superannuation scheme. I've got a good portfolio of shares. I've got a nice house which is nearly paid off for. I've got a banking system that never fails us, not even in South Australia. And everything is all right with the world. I don't need God. It's not really the question of whether it's true or not. But the lie eventually will be seen for each of us if we just keep our eyes open, for the cisterns we dig ourselves eventually leak. The Israelites reject the spring and choose the leaky dam. The idols they make are worthless and make them worthless. And when they turn to them to help, there is no help. When you say in your trouble, come and save us, verse 27, then where are the gods you made for yourselves? Let them come and save you when you're in trouble. For they don't save them when they're in trouble. You cannot be saved. Our community's turning to astrology as if astrology is going to help them. Something like 80% of the community read the star columns regularly. You're very hard pressed to be able to buy a newspaper without the star columns. Some radio stations in their news broadcasts give you the star signs for the day, and what is happening is all part of the news. Time magazine's article can speak of astrologers, partly with tongue in cheek, partly because that's part of what Californians are turning to. The community, as if the stars can help you. As if even knowing what the stars would do if they could do. The astrologers, according to the astronomers, don't even have the stars in the right part of the sky. They have failed to see the shift over the centuries. They've got it totally and wrong. And yet the community is running around as if somehow the stars are going to help. You can buy books on what kind of food to eat if you're which kind of star sign. You can go out and find a partner for life according to your star sign, the kinds of jobs that you should be doing according to your star sign. It is mind-blowing that it is so stupid. As if suddenly 1/12 of us all have the same pattern of personality because we were born in this month or that month. As if somehow this kind of personality will or will not mix with that kind of personality. As if we have the same future tomorrow. One of our congregation actually was used to write star columns. And the star columns that that member of our congregation told me when they were writing them for a magazine, used to just make them up, snip them together, paste from other magazines and from other months. And it's all so ludicrous and so funny, except there are actually 28% of the community out there reading that and making decisions on the basis of it, on the basis of scissors and paste. And this is absolutely mind-blowing, isn't it? And they find belief in God difficult. Because God calls upon them to be honest and holy and righteous. God calls upon them to serve him. Broken cisterns that people turn to. Nations that can't actually, in the end, help. They'll only hurt you. They'll only enslave you. That's the meaning of that verse in verse 16 about the men from Memphis and Tahpenes shave the crown of your head. It's either a symbol of shame, or as the footnote has it, they crack your skulls, which is not so much a symbol as a painful expression. But that's why when they leave the place in verse 37, you'll leave that place with hands on your heads, either for shame or because that's where the blood's coming out. Either way, those nations are not going to help you, is being said. When you're in trouble, you think America is going to help us. Well, I hope they do. They did at the Second World War, didn't they? But does our security in the end lie in America's capacity for helping us? It must not, friends. You can understand why we think that, can't you? You can understand why, well, if that nation ever did invade us, we've got our friends out there. Timor thought like that. The people of West New Guinea thought like that. It's a terrible mistake, isn't it? If we could find some oil, then I'm sure they'll come and defend us. The land has become defiled and infertile because of them, because God is the source of all good things. And their repentance doesn't work either. You see, they think, well, look, I'm innocent. Come back to verse 35? Yes, I'm innocent. God won't be angry with me. How many people in our community think that they are innocent enough that God won't be angry with them? But look what it says. I will pass judgment on you because you say, I have not sinned. That's exactly what makes God so angry, when people are so untruthful as to think that somehow they're not in the wrong, that they're all right. God says we have sinned. And when we're conscious of our sin, what do we do to overcome it? Look back in verse 22. It's like Lady Macbeth, this one. Although you wash yourself with soda and use an abundance of soap, the stain of your guilt is still before me, declares the Sovereign Lord. You think it's somehow God is going to be confused? God is not going to see what we've done because we've covered it up, because we've washed our hands? God is not confused by that. You wash and you wash, but the dirt is not removed because you're still doing it your way. You're not coming to God God's way. And so this awful statement down in verse 4 and 5 of chapter... You think it's somehow God is going to be confused? God is not going to see what we've done because we've covered it up, because we've washed our hands? God is not confused by that. You wash and you wash, but the dirt is not removed because you're still doing it your way. You're not coming to God God's way. And so this awful statement down in verse 4 and 5 of chapter 3. Have you not just called me my father, my friend from my youth? Halfway through chapter 2, they're calling the wood my father. Now they're calling God my father. As if you can just change who you're calling when it comes to a desperate moment of need. You know, as if most of my life I give to what I want to do, but suddenly in the surf I'm in trouble, so I say, well, God, you can help me now. You don't like being treated that way by your friends, do you? You don't like them ringing you up only when they're in difficulty, only when they're in need? Well, why would you expect God to be happy with you ringing him up just when in need, just when in difficulty? That's not going to solve your problems. Have you not just called me my father, my friend from my youth? Will you always be angry with me? Will your wrath continue forever? This is how you talk, but you do all the evil you can. How can the people of God be accepted back? Sometimes, friends, all too often, a marriage fails in our community. A relationship that started so devotedly, as they all do, but forgets. And the partners forget to feed themselves on each other's love and to feed each other's love. And people wander. They wander to alternatives which at first start out to be so harmless. The garden, the children, the career, the car, the overseas trips. But progressively become more and more dangerous as they move to things which are real replacements of their partner and of their commitment to each other, until they move to alternative partners. And then how do you put it back together again? Well, you can't wallpaper over the cracks and pretend that with suitable words that everything's all right. there comes time when it really is radical surgery. And radical surgery always hurts. Oh, not at the moment, maybe because of an anaesthetic, but in due time. I mean, it doesn't matter how much the doctors may say to us, well, it'll only hurt a little bit, we know. It hurts a lot. It's the character of it, isn't it? It really hurts. But it's the way to get better. So is our relationship with God. In Christ Jesus, our bridegroom, we have the one who has died to make our reconciliation with God possible, who has died to clean us up properly. But we must turn back in reality, not just in words. Not just saying, oh, I'm sorry, God, as you go out to do it again. It's got to do with real change. Turning back and nourishing our relationship with truth. We must turn back in reality. Do you need that at the moment? Is that where you're at? That really you have wandered away from God? Oh, you can remember the time when you were close to Him and wanted to follow Him. You remember the promises of youth when you were going to. But everything else in life is crowded out so that really your faith and confidence is not so much in God as in yourself and everything else. It may be that you've seen it hasn't worked. It may be that you see it's still working. But you know that you have actually wandered from God. You need to turn back. You can't just do it superficially, although you can rest assured of forgiveness and mercy. For God has sent His Son into this world to die, that we will be forgiven, that pardon will be made, but the change must be real. The surgery must be genuine. And the things that you have started to hold very dear may well have to be cut out. And people faced up to, and truth be told, and risks be taken as you confess your error. Well, if so, take action, friends. For the cisterns you have dug are broken cisterns that will fail you in the long run. Whereas God is a spring of water, of living water, who can restore and replenish you eternally. And if you know that you are indeed calling God as Father from your heart, then keep on doing what you are doing this very morning, listening to His word. Do not be like the people of Israel who stopped listening, who stopped asking about the Lord. But keep listening and keep teaching each other and encouraging each other that our relationship with Him may go on and prosper and keep our faith and trust in Him alone. I'm not sure that Jeremiah gives us great grounds for questions, and I am sure that it's time we gave a quit at this point. But I think this is the kind of passage which challenges us to be taking action for our lives, especially in prayer. And on our outline, I see we've got printed for us a confession. And that might be a good place in which we might all pray now. So let's pray.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.